Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Thursday edition. Today's date is November 16th, 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me today. We have a returning guest today, but before we do that, I want to talk to you a little bit about a couple of points here. You know, the French Connections archives are not radio shows. They're investigative broadcasts that we did. We bring on guests. And so what I'm trying to say here is that, please, because we don't do a show every night, that doesn't mean that you can't still continue to learn great things from the past work we've done. Our archives in both the written and the audio files are top-notch, very well-researched, extremely, I think, effective in giving people, especially newcomers, an idea of what we all face. And it's something that, sad to say, I don't think American public is really going to wake up until it feels a great deal more pain than they already have. However, I don't think that's going to be long in coming at this point anyway. So I think there may be a real need for this information, and I'd like to urge everyone out there to attempt to put this information onto hard copy. We need to have you put these onto CDs and onto into paper form, because the Internet may not always be here, and the French Connection would live on in your archive. So please do that. It's a good idea. Anyway, my guest today, somebody that I invited back last week, and he's been looking into some very important information about the Democrat Party. You know, we've talked a lot about it recently with Pelosi and recent Murtha attempt at being the whip of the majority whip, and now we've got another a man involved in the majority whip. But he's been looking into a man that works behind the scenes to control the caucuses and the work in the Democrat Party, named Rahm Emanuel, and his connections to Israel and just what this guy's guy means here. So I'm going to bring him up right now. His name is Christopher Bolin, world famous investigative reporter. Christopher, are you with me?
Hello, Daryl. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you great. You know, the Democrat Party has just recently gone with this new choice here instead of Murtha. They're picking this other fellow. What's his name here? Stoll, is it?
Stoyer.
Yeah. Now, I looked up Stoyer and his past record, and boy, is this guy in the pocket of the Zionists. I can't believe he's... You know, Murtha had a couple of connections, but this guy is riddled with it from top to bottom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any surprises there to you?
Well, no, it doesn't surprise me, because if you look at the powerhouse in the Democratic Party for this election, it's being the much vaunted individual is an Israeli himself. It's Rahm Emanuel.
Yep.
And he's, so to speak, the general behind the victory. At least that's how the Chicago Tribune, I'm speaking to you from Chicago. And they did an entire section in Sunday's paper dedicated to Rahm Emanuel. He's a congressman from Illinois, from Chicago area, and the title was "How Rahm Emanuel Helped End an Era of Republican Rule," and it's 9 pages long. It's an entire section of the paper devoted to this fella. But what I wanted to tell you today about is his father. This Rahm Emanuel's father came from Israel in the 50s, like many other Israelis, and he was a hardcore Zionist. He was a terrorist, in fact. He was a member of the Irgun. A terrorist.
Can you give the people an idea what the Irgun was in yeah, Israeli history?
Sure. Well, the Irgun is spelled I-R-G-U-N, and it's an organization that's it's in Hebrew, it's Irgun Tzvi Leumi. It's a Jabotinsky militia, and it was dedicated to fighting the Arabs and creating a state in Israel. And it started, I think, in 1931 and lasted until 1948. But it's important to understand that under the British Mandate period, the Jewish Agency, the Haganah, and the the Histadrut, these Israeli organizations, these Yishuv, pre-Israeli organizations, all considered Irgun to be a terrorist organization. It was headed by people like Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin was the last commander. And they even have these are the people who blew up the King David Hotel.
Didn't they have a reputation for being vicious? They went into several villages in advance of the Israeli state and actually murdered thousands of people and yes. I mean, just brutal stuff.
Yes, in the Arab revolt that lasted from 1936 to 1939, this is when the Palestinian, the local population, was very upset by the great immigration of Jews, Eastern European Jews, into Palestine. And the British tried to stop it, and the Palestinians reacted to this inflow of people, and it created a revolt, a kind of intifada. And in that intifada, 5,000 Arabs were killed, and something like 400 Jews died. So it's very similar to today's intifada situations where Palestinians are killed 10 to 1.
Yeah. Well, now we move it forward. Now, we've got this guy, Emmanuel. What was his original name? That's not his...
That's a very good question. The family's original name was Auerbach. Auerbach. A-U-E-R-B-A-C-H. And I spoke to his father. His father's a doctor from Israel, and his name is Benjamin Emmanuel. And the way, what their story is, there's a lot of articles. There's a lot of articles in the American media these days about Rahm Emanuel, but they all gloss over his father's background with the Israeli, what they call, in the Chicago Tribune article, they say that he worked with the Jewish underground in pre-state Israel. Well, that is the biggest gloss over I've ever seen. He was a member of the Irgun. I spoke to Rahm Emanuel's father twice in the last couple of days. He was very open about that. But when I asked him today questions, more direct questions, questions about his role, he quickly decided he didn't want to be have any more phone interviews. Now, it's important because, you know, here in Chicago, we had Sherman Skolnick, and Skolnick says about Rahm Emanuel, he said that Rahm Emanuel has been the acting deputy chief for North America of the Mossad. That's what Sherman Skolnick said. And Skolnick went on to say that Emanuel is no stranger to political assassination. His father was reputed to be part of the Israeli assassination team that murdered Sweden's Count Volker Bernadotte, part of the United Nations team in Palestine in 1948. Volker Bernadotte was the UN envoy who was there to sort out the partition plan of 47, who was murdered by four individuals, in Jerusalem. One of them was Yitzhak Shamir, we know that.
Yeah.
And these are the kinds of things that Sherman Skolnick was writing about, and in order to get, you know, to see if this is true, I called up to Rahm Emanuel's father and spoke to him, and to get some information, and I've learned a great deal about him.
Well, now, Sherman Skolnick in some quarters is not believable. And now, did you find his report to have credence or not?
No, like I say about Sherman Skolnick is that he says these things all the time, and he doesn't document them. So you have to try and document them yourself. I mean, he goes on to say an interesting thing about Rahm Emanuel is that he was in the White House with Clinton. In the Oval Office, he had an office right there, and he's the guy, Rahm Emanuel is the guy that pushed through NAFTA. That's important to understand. The North American Free Trade Agreement was pushed through by Rahm Emanuel, and Rahm Emanuel was the political strategist. He was the political director for the Clinton administration from 1992 to like 1994.
What tactics did he use in order to get that document signed?
Strong-arm tactics. Because if you read about Rahm Emanuel, that's all he practices. He's a little guy. He's like 5'8", a former ballet dancer. But he practices strong-arm tactics. That is, he extorts, he cajoles. His methods of raising money for Mayor Daley when Mayor Daley was running, or Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton was running, can only be described as strong-arm tactics.
Now, did this relationship that he had with Clinton, did it find itself into any of the characters we're seeing within the Bush administration, such as Abramoff, or is his relationship with Foxman well known?
Yeah, well, you would have to say, I don't know about his relationship with Foxman, but you'd have to say that Rahm Emanuel, as Skolnick says, that he was the acting deputy chief of the Mossad for North America. Well, we don't know if that's the case, but you can see by Rahm Emanuel's relationship with the State of Israel, particularly with the extreme right wing in the State of Israel. That needs to be understood. The Irgun was the Jabotinsky militia. It was founded by Zeev Jabotinsky, who is the most radical revisionist Zionist of the time. And these are the people like Menachem Begin and others who are criminals, and they are terrorists, and they are the people who have done the most damage to Zionism. Zionism, I would say, and to the Middle East. Now,
well, you know, it's interesting because the Jewish community in America, by and large, blindly supports these people's efforts. And I don't think many of them are even aware of the depth of depravity that they will sink to get their ends met. I mean, they will suspend all ethics to have their way.
Yeah, but the thing is that the American Jewish community, of course, is not monolithic, and the Israeli Jewish community is less so. But I mean, there's a lot of people who support, for example, or say they support labor governments in Israel. But when it gets down to it, you will find that there's not a lot of difference between labor and Likud. Look at example for today. We now have this new party, the Kadima Party, Forward Party, with Ehud Olmert.
Yes.
Ehud Olmert is from the Likud. He is from this extreme Irgun Jabotinsky school of Zionism. Yet his deputy prime minister is Shimon Peres, the father of the Labor Party. So, you know, it's mostly for outside consumption, like the Democrats and Republicans, the difference between the Labor and the Likud. Because when it gets down to it, they both believe in an exclusively Jewish state. In Palestine.
Well, now, I've known for a long time, and so have you, and many have written about it, that there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Democrat and Republican Party as far as exterior policy. Basically, it's the method that changes a little, but not the goals.
Well, that's a very good point. And like I said, that NAFTA was pushed through by Rahm Emanuel, an Israeli. He was an Israeli citizen until he was 18 years old, when obviously he would have had to come up and serve for military duty in the state of Israel. But he grew up in the North Shore of Chicago. So at age 18, he gave up that citizenship. But you see, there again, he remains an Israeli national, and he can reclaim that citizenship simply by going to the embassy and reclaiming it. He didn't denounce it. He didn't renounce Israel. And it's interesting to note that in 1991, during the Gulf War, he went to Israel and served in the Israeli military. Now, this man is in the U.S. Congress. This is one of the, you know, the golden boy, so-called golden boy of the Democratic Party. His father is a known terrorist, served in a terrorist organization. And yet Rahm Emanuel is writing, you know, articles and things about how to fight the war on terror. You know, people don't understand is that the concept of terrorism, the modern-day concept of political terrorism, originated with the Zionists, particularly
right.
The Irgun Party in Israel in 1945-46,
right.
Like that.
Well, now, I also know that during the 1970s, when they needed to splash the hatred they wanted to spread against Islam across the airwaves, they started employing false terrorists, such as Abu Nidal.
Yes.
And this guy went around the Middle East. And here's the interesting thing. He was always one step ahead of the law. And, you know, and he would always show up in places that you would expect anyone to get caught, but yet he never did.
Kind of like Osama bin Laden, right?
Yeah, you know, the guy you can never nail down, you know, or Zarqawi or something.
There's a pattern to this madness. There's a pattern to the Zionist terror. And that's why the article that they didn't print in American Free Press that I wrote in May was very important, because I was saying that the American people need to understand the origins of Zionism, the players, and the strategies, because these strategies have been repeated. You know, they bombed the King David Hotel in July 1946, and to my reasoning, they bombed the World Trade Center on 11th of September 2001.
Yeah.
The thing is that the patterns, the strategies, the operations, like you say, the false flag terror, or the co-opting of terrorist groups, like, you know, Sharon actually was the founder of Hamas. But Hamas became, you know, more independent on its own. But they created, the Israelis created Hamas in order to buy against the PLO at the time.
Well, and also so that they would never have to cut a real peace deal in that area, because if they needed a bad guy, and since they pulled the strings, they could create a bad guy anytime they needed one.
Precisely. And the thing is that this Jabotinsky school of Zionism, like you could call it that, is the iron fist school of Zionism. That is that they use brute force and the Berlin Wall, that wall they built across the Holy Land, to because they believe that Palestine should be Palestinians should be pushed out of Palestine.
That's right.
And that only Jews should live there. They're extremely racist. They're extremely racist people, and they have no qualms about doing false flag terror.
Well, they don't even have any qualms against injuring their own public.
No. Right, right. Or their own. You know, these group of people, the Shamirs and the Sharons and the Begins, have been known to kill other Israelis.
Yeah, yeah. And especially when somebody's not agreeing with them. And I mean, here's the situation now. They infiltrated our system at the turn of the last century in large measure through financing from international bankers. But they found their way into our Supreme Court through Brandeis. Mm-hmm. They got through into our Hollywood by setting it up with their own monies. In other words, they infiltrated every segment of our society. And it hasn't been until about 1960 they started flexing their political clout in the country. And where we find ourselves 40 years later is in their complete control at the moment.
Well, they flexed their clout in, 1913 or 1916 when they created the income tax.
And yeah, the Federal Reserve, right.
Federal Reserve. I mean, they were certainly playing big roles and also in pushing the United States into World War I and World War II.
Yep.
But, you know, when you mentioned about this finance thing, that's very interesting because it should be noted that Rahm Emanuel today is a multimillionaire. He earned $18 million. He went to work for Wasserstein Perella. After he left the Clinton White House, and he worked there for a few years, and that bank or that investment company, Wasserstein Perella, was sold then to the Dresdner Bank for $1 billion, something like that, and he received reportedly received $18 million, for his few years that he worked at that bank, and you know, this is the thing, is that this guy, if one were to look into what he did when he was at that bank and what that little investment bank did, I mean, this guy, this Rahm Emanuel's family has so much, is tainted in so many ways, yet the mainstream media in this country, you know, they portray him as being the golden boy. And
yeah.
I mean, they're going to try and probably run this guy for president because he actually was born in the United States. His family came here when his mother was 4 months pregnant.
Well, now, so here's the interesting thing. His architecture that was that is the Democrat Party,
yeah,
and its recent victory. Many people believe that we're going to have a regression in the Zionist influence in the government. But what's actually happened is they've increased their numbers by 4 in the House of Representatives and by 2 in the Senate. So in other words, the Jewish community is more represented now than before the election.
Yeah, and it's important, you know, like Rahm Emanuel was the big fundraiser for Bill Clinton in 1992.
Mm.
And it's very similar to Lou Eisenberg, the former director of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, the person who oversaw the privatization of the World Trade Center, is the treasurer of the Republican National Committee. So, I mean, in both cases, you have the money behind both parties. It's the same like with Tony Blair in Britain.
Yeah.
Lord Levy is Mr. Money for Tony Blair. Well, whether it's the Bush, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats, you will find big Zionist sources of money behind both.
That's right.
And like you said, there's not a dime worth of difference when you get down to their position on the war, their position on Palestine. For example, this Rahm Emanuel was asked if he would have supported the war on terror, even if he had known that there were no weapons of mass destruction. He said, sure. Sure he would. Well, of course, because it's a long-term Zionist strategy to destroy Iraq.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's the thing, is that, and Rahm Emanuel is going to be, is a key guy, because he supposedly was the director who chose which candidates to support, which candidates to fund. That's why the Chicago Tribune is writing that he's the guy who helped end the Republican era. But you see, obviously, you have to ask yourself, why were there no Democrats who were strongly opposed to the war?
Except Marissa.
Right.
And I think, you know, Marissa was put in there as a stutter step to maybe give everybody in the country an idea that, well, we're not against anti-war people, but we just, you know, he was outmaneuvered by this guy Hoyer.
Well, look what happened to this girl here in Chicago area, the lady who was a vet who lost both legs.
Yeah.
And she was defeated. You know, and when one has to remember, of course, we don't count votes in Chicago. We don't count votes in the United States.
Yeah.
We let private companies count the votes for us.
Uh-huh.
So, but it doesn't make a lot of sense. So the anti-war candidates in the Democratic Party are winding up on the losing end of the side, right?
That's right. That's right.
And people like Rahm Emanuel, who is very much pro-war on the Democratic Party, in the Democratic Party, is being promoted as the golden boy of the Democratic Party. So, you know, when is this war going to end?
Well, it has. They have no intention of ending it. And, in fact, if it costs every American young man in the country, it would mean very little to them, because what I've discovered by knowing the history of this group from way back in the First World War, Second World War, the steps of Russia and the murders that went on, they're willing to kill any non-Jew indiscriminately without any remorse.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, so what do we face now? We've got.
Well, the thing is also is that these wars, like World War I, World War II, are meant to decimate the population of the countries involved, because the you know, whenever they see non-Jews dying in large numbers, for them that's in their perverted way of looking at the world, that's a good thing.
Well, and it seems that you know, for a long time we've connected the dots to know that they're fomenting hatred between Christianity and Islam in order for us to fight ourselves bloody. And they're going to sit back and just be the puppet masters in this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course they've got many governments in Europe behind them. The Germans follow along like blind puppy dogs, and then the French are behind them most of the time, especially on the important issues. You know, they'll pick at the edges. They'll say, "Oh, we don't agree with this or that." But on the general flow of what they want, they're getting 100% of what they want. I'm saying to you that in almost every Western country, if not all Western countries, these people have a foothold, if not complete control.
Yes, that's true. And it's obviously in the media. The media is the primary source of their control, because through the media, you know, such small actors as a 5'8" Israeli congressman become the large golden boy of Congress. You know, and it's the same way that Israel, like a French foreign minister, I think a few years ago, called Israel that shitty little state in the Middle East. But how these little players, these small countries, these small interests, these small people become larger than life.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, like this entire section of the Chicago Tribune that was written about Rahm Emanuel over the weekend was written by a journalist named Naftali Ben-David. And Naftali Ben-David, well, that's a very Israeli name. So I called up the Chicago Tribune yesterday to find out if they could tell me who Naftali Ben-David was. They did tell me he was a man, but when I said, "Is he Israeli?" they refused to answer the question. And this is pretty typical. So I said, "Well, you know, what kind of paper you all run there? You know, you're writing 9 pages about Rahm Emanuel, and you don't even mention that his father was a member of a terrorist organization."
Yeah. And what was their response?
Well, that's the way they are. You know, they asked me some questions, and I said, "Yes, his father was a member of the Irgun." I said, "You can call him up. He's in Wilmette. He's still alive. He's at his house. He's a retired doctor. Give him a call and talk to him." But of course, they won't do that. They won't do that. And, you know, they talk about how this Emanuel family, how the Auerbach family became the Emanuel family, was that his brother, in one article says in 1933, another article is in 1938, that he died in Palestine, or he was killed. Well, Rahm Emanuel's father told me it was in 1936, and that he died in this Arab revolt. And he got some shrapnel in his knee and an infection, and he died. But when I asked him today, could you tell me a little bit more detail, how was it that your brother Emanuel died? That's when he decided he didn't want to talk on the phone anymore. And the thing is that at that point, when that brother died, they changed their name. The family name was changed from Auerbach to Emanuel. But one has to understand that was a very common practice in Israel. Most families that came to Israel from Russia or Poland, what have you, changed their name and gave themselves an Israeli-sounding name. And,
yeah.
And you ask yourself, where did those 6 million Jews from Europe go? Well, a lot of them went to Palestine, changed their names, and no longer existed as they were formerly known in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here's what I'm looking at, and with these facts that we've got all, we're facing a barrage of different events from Iraq to financial messes coming across the world. And I'm taking a look at this and I'm saying to myself, it's not going to get better until we wake up the world to just how desperate our situation really is. I see movement, Christopher. We have moved the ball down the field, but we're missing that element, that one thing that's going to turn the thing on in our favor. And I'm wondering what that is going to be. And I start thinking that it's probably going to be financial. What's your take on that?
Yeah, you're probably right, because it's happening all the time. The financial situation in the United States and in primarily the United States is getting worse and worse all the time. It's just being papered over, so people don't feel the pain quite so strongly. But the huge debt, the national debt and the consumer debt in this country is it's extraordinary. It's beyond belief.
Well, isn't it interesting to note that the Jewish bankers involved in making credit available to people who don't deserve it, which is exactly what happened, and they ran the economy down into a place where we're just a debtor nation. We're beholden to every other country on earth, and they had the control of those strings. Those puppet strings were in their hands, and so the implosion of America seems completely deliberate from my standpoint.
Yeah, and the greater the debt, as Bush racks up in these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the greater control these bankers have over the government, because they cannot continue to do the things they do without getting loans from these banks and the Jewish control is just increasing immensely, day by day. I realized for decades that we're living in Jewish times, but I didn't realize the degree that we're living into the Zionist times. That is to say, when these hardcore Zionists are actually the people that are in power. It's not just Jewish. It's not just some Jewish fellow down the street. No, it's a hardcore, no prisoners taken group of people who originate primarily in places like Brest-Litovsk and Lithuania and that very small region, really, where Lithuania and today Belarusia and Poland come together. That area, that northern part of the Pale of Settlement, is where all of these people come from. And you'd be amazed how, for example, so many of them come from one place, like Brest-Litovsk. Begin comes from there, Sharon comes from there, Shamir comes from there. There's a group, and they knew each other. Their fathers or their grandfathers, busted down the temple doors in Brest-Litovsk. I mean, it's incredible.
And if you take a look at it, what influence does the Lubavitch have in this whole equation?
Oh, the Lubavitch, Rabbi Lubavitch.
Well, the Lubavitchers, the city of Lubavitch is right in that region you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Menachem Schneerson.
Yeah. That's their religious foundation. But it's interesting that a lot of these people from that same area, people from Bialystok, Poland, with Bialystok today, or from Kaunas, or from Vilnius, what they said Vilno, I think, in those days, in their language, they came to the United States, and in many cases, I look into these records of the census and things, and these people listed, many of them listed their language as Yiddish, but a lot of them listed their language as being Hebrew, which is quite unusual because, of course, Hebrew was only reconstituted as a spoken language like in 1910.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where, that is this hotbed of Zionism. But this Zionism that came out of these people, it's a criminal Zionism. It's not the cultured high level Zionism that a lot of American Jews like to believe in. This is the Zionism where it's cut your throat Zionism.
Yeah. Well,
anybody who gets in the way.
Well, see, it's teleological suspension of ethical principles. It's the ends justifying the means in every case.
That's right. That's right. Precisely.
Yeah. And what we're facing now, we've got a situation, Christopher, that's painful to me to watch. We can call George Bush the biggest bumbling boob ever,
yeah,
or we can say that about Cheney or Rumsfeld or anything. But if you say it about someone like Mr. Chertoff,
there you go.
All of a sudden, you can't say that anymore. All of a sudden, he's the guy that's pulling the strings and levers in the government, yet he's beyond criticism.
That's a very good observation. When I was in Europe on the speaking tour with Jimmy Walter and Eric Hirschfeld, there was some speaker, there were several speakers there. Phil Berg comes to mind, Webster Tarpley, people who directly lay the blame for 9/11 at the doorstep of Dick Cheney and George Bush and these group of people in the U.S. government. In fact, Webster Tarpley's book has on the front cover about 9/11, Made in USA.
Right.
And I've always rejected that thesis because I'm an American, and it just didn't seem to me that this, I've never seen any evidence that this entire complot, this conspiracy to destroy the World Trade Center, was an American-made product. In fact, most of the evidence indicates that it was an Israeli-made product.
Yeah.
But when I would, when I was to speak, I was called down every day, and I had to defend my position, and I was not allowed to speak in Vienna, for example. And my opinion and my facts, my evidence, my research on 9/11 is taboo in this country. It's beyond the pale, so to speak.
Yeah.
Whereas people like Webster Tarpley and Phil Berg are on CNN News.
Yeah.
See? So it is kosher to blame Bush and Cheney. It's kosher to blame the Republican Party, but it is absolutely not kosher to identify Israeli involvement in 9/11.
Well, we've got a lot of false flaggers out there, and I'll give you another example of one that Eric and I sniffed out right away, was this Sybelle Edmonds. You know, when she was putting her story together, of course, all roads led back to Arabs and to Saudi Arabia,
yeah,
and to Tajikistan and to transfers of money from Pakistan. And
is she the one that talked about PTEC?
She's the one who supposedly translated some documents in the FBI,
yeah,
and then said, and of course, the only, now here's the interesting thing. She's got a documentary here on European television talking about the connections to Tajikistan and talking about the connections to the Bush White House, talking, but nothing to say about Israel, nothing.
Right. There was the Sybelle Edmonds, I remember she was the Turkish lady. And
yes,
there was another lady in the early 9/11 movement who talked about the PTEC Corporation, and she was doing the same thing. I remember when she spoke at the 9/11 thing we had in Washington D.C. in June of 2002. That Kyle Hintz had one of those events, and this woman was talking about this corporation PTEC, this computer company PTEC.
Yeah,
she talked about how this company was founded by these Lebanese Arab. And Lebanese Arab fellas, and that found the money was coming from Saudi Arabia, from some dodgy fella in Saudi Arabia. And I just poked around, looked into that company she was talking about, and found that the person who was in charge of the company, the person who was in charge of obtaining the software and marketing the software, was a man named Michael Goff. Well, that's neither Saudi nor Lebanese. That's a Jewish guy from Massachusetts, from Worcester, Mass, whose father and grandfather were 33-degree Freemasons in the B'nai B'rith.
Yeah.
And he had been a practicing lawyer with a very Zionist law firm in Worcester, Mass, who suddenly quit that job and went and worked for this dodgy Lebanese Saudi firm, right? Well, you see, this is the kind of cutout we're talking about. There's a cutout is the idea that you cut out an image of something and you make it look like it's an Arab with Saudi financing. But who is the player behind that cutout image is an Israeli.
That's right. Well, you know, and see, but the interesting thing is, even here in Europe, when she put her story to Selenoid, when she put it down into a documentary, the lies that she spun out of her documentary are being played across Europe right now on many channels. And, it's no different than this Michael Moore character that they brought out, to at first fan the flames of the Arabs did it. And the Americans were somehow complicit, and again we're back in the same situation here. I mean,
eventually you brought up Michael Moore. Rahm Emanuel's brother is a Hollywood agent. His name is Ariel, and Ariel Emanuel, his brother, is a very wealthy agent. He's the agent for Michael Moore. Small world, huh?
Yeah, you know, and when you open the refrigerator door, just stink comes out, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Christopher, when we look through this stuff and we try to explain it to people, and we here's another one. I'll give you somebody that has disappointed both Eric and I from the beginning, but he has a lot of facts, but when it comes down to making the next jump, it won't be done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Alex Jones. Of course, Alex Jones ends up having tens of thousands of listeners across America, and he will only nibble around the edges of the truth when it comes to the Israeli connection. And this is no different than Sybil Edmonds. This is no different than Michael Moore. They serve you up a platter of 85% facts, and 15% of it goes awry, but it's the most important 15%.
Right, right. Well, that's pretty typical of the controlled media.
That's right.
And if he's working with those people, you know, that's what you get.
Well, you know, we don't always know, and see, because sometimes people want to be protecting their career,
mm-hmm.
and they know that if they come too far out on the truth, they're going to get, you know, he maybe has 25 affiliates in the country. I'm sure if he started saying all the facts that we know, the B'nai B'rith would have him driven off 20 radio stations overnight.
That's right. That's right. Well, look what happened to me. Look what happened to Professor Jones.
Yeah.
You know, reveal too much or start, you know, talking about things that they don't want you talking about, they pull the podium away.
Well, here's one that I want to bring up. Of course, they started saying that my wife is an African-American, which wouldn't matter to me if I loved her. I would marry an African-American woman if she was someone I loved. But you sat at my Thanksgiving table here, and is my wife an African-American?
No. Yeah, she's, I saw that, and I think that Mike Piper is the one that wrote that. He wrote
yeah.
that about your wife. That's completely false. Your wife is a French girl.
Yeah, but see, what this is how far they will stoop to undermine someone's credibility. See, when they can't fight you on the facts, Christopher, they start sliming you.
Well, look what this Michael Piper I used to work with, and he was talking about me being the greatest reporter, investigative reporter, this and that.
Yeah.
And then as soon as he started stabbing me in the back, I became a member of Scientology because I'm editing a book for a doctor who writes about Prozac and antidepressants, the danger these things cause, you know, and how they're involved in the school shootings. And suddenly I become a Scientologist, and he spreads this around on the Internet. I'm a Scientologist. It's just like the same thing what this Wing TV people did, Victor Thorne, Scott McCoofka, and Lisa Giuliani. They would say the damnedest things about me, you know, right after I got arrested. They said they went on the air and said that they spoke to the police department and said that I must have been lying, that there's no water in the cell, because the police then told them that there's water in every cell.
Yeah.
See, but they never called me or anything.
Well, but see the whole thing is about if you can't battle them on the facts, use the old standby and you know, make it up.
Yeah.
And
attack the messenger.
Yeah, attack the messenger. And but see, from my standpoint over here, we're these humble guys here. I know your situation. I know Eric's situation. Now you know my situation.
Yeah.
I'm not living in the lap of luxury here. I'm a guy struggling, but I know enough to say that if I don't stand up now, and if we don't do something now, this is going to be our future, and there's not going to be a chance to defeat this mess we face. So the Chertoffs of the world and the Begins and the rest of these criminals that are at our throats constantly.
That's the thing that Americans, as long as Americans remain oblivious to the Zionist agenda, the first thing is that they, you know, our government, our Congress, is obviously pursuing the Zionist agenda with their wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and their support of the Israeli government. Even when the Israeli government is dropping cluster bombs on Lebanese civilians, the United States is airlifting more bombs of the same sort to this criminal regime in Israel that's committing these war crimes.
Yep.
So obviously the government is pursuing the Zionist agenda, and the American people are completely oblivious to what that is.
Yeah.
As long as the situation continues, we are an occupied nation.
Well, we already are, and if you take a look at everything, we're living in tyranny.
It would not take very much for us to stop this.
No, it wouldn't.
If enough people were to understand what's at stake and what's going on.
Well, what's at stake is simply everything.
That's right.
And, you know, I'm looking right at my computer screen right now, and I've got Pelosi sitting here looking at me, and Eric and I did a peek behind her, a peek up her skirt for a minute, and we found is the Star of David everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, almost to a point of blatant. And you know, her first constituency she talked to after winning this most recent position of House Speaker was the Jewish community. She didn't go to her constituency that elected her. She didn't go and speak to Californians or to her district. She went to the Jewish community and talked about how wonderful it was that she was going to be representing their interests.
Yeah, well, that's fairly obligatory when you live in Zionist-occupied territory like she does. And that's you know, when we talk about Congress being Zionist-occupied territory, it's not a joke. It's not hyperbole.
What could you promise a true American that they would sell out their countrymen in such a way? There's nothing you could promise me that I would do that. I mean, there's not enough money, there's not enough fame, there's not enough position or power.
Like Rahm Emanuel, one of his most the way that he extorts money out of people and things is that he blackmails them. That's what Skolnick and other people have said about him. He has information on people, he has things on people, and that way he doesn't get just donations, he extorts donations from people and is able to raise money. He's like known as Mr. Moneybags. Now, and that's the same thing in Congress, is that in many of these cases, these people are being blackmailed. You have a congressman who maybe likes little boys, or you have a congressman who's got a homosexual side life.
But do you think if somebody was going to out me as a homosexual, that I would destroy my own nation on that one fear? Come on, I would say, yeah, you know, who cares?
A lot of these people don't see it at that level. And you'd be surprised what people will do for $10,000, $20,000. You'd be surprised what people would do, for a small amount of money, for that proverbial two pieces of silver. You know, one of the apostles sold out Jesus Christ for two pieces of silver.
That's right.
People will sell out their country, their family, and everything for two pieces of silver.
Yeah. Well, now here's the interesting thing, Christopher. Where are we in good company in this world? I mean, I know somebody Ahmadinejad is on the surface looks like the right guy, mm-hmm. but are we in good company with him?
Oh, I don't know. I can't speak for Ahmadinejad. I've never met him.
No, but I mean his policies and his stand and stuff.
Well, he's from what I've seen about what he says and his position on his Iran's nuclear program and on the Holocaust and whatnot, makes complete sense.
Yeah.
And there's one point here that needs to be said about Ahmadinejad. When 2 years ago or so on Jerusalem Day at the end of the Islamic holiday, when he said that the what they interpreted to say that the Zionist regime has to be destroyed, he said that the regime that occupies the, it was said on Jerusalem Day. That's the last day of the holiday of the holy month of Ramadan. And when they celebrate, it's called Jerusalem Day. And he said that the occupying regime of Jerusalem has to be destroyed. Now, it's understood by all nations in the world, in the United Nations, that Jerusalem is illegally occupied. The occupation of Jerusalem by the Zionist state is illegal. And there are countless or numerous UN resolutions calling for the Zionist army, the Israeli army, to pull out of occupied Jerusalem. The United States does not have its embassy there because it is considered occupied territory. So all he was doing was saying what every other nation has said in writing, in print. That is that the occupation of Jerusalem is illegal. But what they had to make it sound much worse than that. They had to make it sound like he's Hitler and he wants to kill all the Jewish people. Nothing of the sort. And of course, you should remember, of course, that Hitler was a Zionist.
So, well, he was.
And they mix everything up. They mix everything up and they just call him names when, from what he said about the Holocaust and everything, it makes sense to me.
Well, you know, we're getting traction in many, many communities around the world. In Africa, the continent of Africa has been awoken to many of our facts, and so has many parts of Europe. But I'm wondering if we're going to be able to get the traction. I think they've accelerated some of their activities because I think they see a flow of history moving against them.
Well, it's interesting you mention Africa because, you know, even today, and they're pushing in the Darfur conference, they're pushing for Balkanization of Sudan. They're doing everything they can to represent Sudan as the next Yugoslavia, a country that, you know, has a restive minority pushing for separation, and they desperately want UN forces to go in there and to lop off that mineral-rich section that's the size of France, I think, Darfur.
Yeah.
It's loaded with oil, and it's the people, like there's big oil companies. One of them should be noted is the Swedish oil company, and that company is very closely tied. You know, Kofi Annan is married to a Wallenberg woman, and you know, so I mean, it's a small world. You know, when Kofi Annan is pushing for UN forces in Darfur, yeah, it's just like when they push for UN forces in Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
Look at Kosovo. Kosovo remains occupied today, and that very, very wealthy mine, the Trepča mine in Kosovo, has been run since day one of the NATO occupation by three European companies.
And what is it they're mining there?
In Trepča, well, gold, for example. It's a
gold?
It's a very big repository. It's considered Europe's richest mine. It's in Kosovo. It's called Trepča, T-R-E-P-C-A, a little circumflex above the C. And that mine is the wealthiest in Europe. And they, as soon as NATO took over Kosovo, they said, this mine is too dirty. Your smelters are too dirty. It's too much pollution. We have to take it over. And it turned it over to a Swedish company, a French company, and a U.S. mining company. And they've been mining it ever since.
Mm.
And immense amounts of gold have been taken out of that mine and other precious, you know, valuable minerals.
But well, you know,
thing, you know, in Yugoslavia, it's the same sort of thing in Yugoslavia as that they want to do in the Iraq, what they want to do to Iran.
Same thing in Zimbabwe, what they're doing under Mugabe.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we found out there's a Dutch a Jew behind that stuff.
Yeah. Well, the name of the game is called Balkanization, and they, wherever they can stir up a minority and a little conflict, they will excuse them to go in and occupy the region or put in a armed presence. You see, that's what they're so worked up about Darfur. You know, I've never seen the international community in New York be so exercised about a conflict in Africa as they are about Darfur. And if you look at who's behind this Darfur organization, it's white Jewish guys.
Yeah.
The one that took out the full page ad, I forgot, the Darfur organization, but there's this big organization in New York City. And he took out a full page ad in the New York Times last week for, you know, calling for Darfur. He does it on a weekly basis, actually, that we have to, you know, they show some picture of some poor Sudanese person or, you know, some miserable picture, and they say, you know, like they compare it to the Holocaust. We can't say we didn't know. Call for action now in Darfur. What have you, you know?
Oh, boy. Well, you know something, Christopher, there's going to be darker days on our horizon. However, you know, out of dust can come a great awakening. People need to lose some of the things they've got, and I think they will soon. I mean, they've got to get out of their comfort zone and start thinking outside the box here.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you see any situation, well, that may happen soon.
Well, yeah, the financial crisis, if it's to happen, you know, LaRouche is always talking about that, but the middle class in this country is getting squeezed every which way.
Yeah.
And that is causing an awakening. You know, Americans no longer, feel cool or comfortable. They've lost so much in the past 40 years, in standard of living. And, you know, now it's the same sort of thing, except now husbands and wives both have to work. And they can barely make ends meet, and their debt is growing, and you know, but they just can't see the big picture because they're constantly being deluded by this mainstream media. You know, they come home at night and turn on the television, and the indoctrination begins.
Yeah,
and that's the biggest problem we have actually is that you know, the media is our biggest enemy.
Well, Christopher, I want to thank you for putting in this hour of a great informational radio here. You know, we don't do a lot of any more interviews because we've told the story. When we get something to move the ball forward, we add to it like we did today. And I'm going to invite you back as often as you'd like to show up and share with us what you're doing. French Connection and IamTheWitness.com is always available to you. And, you know, Eric and I, we talk every day trying to put out something for everybody to at least keep them interested in fighting with us. And I want to thank you for helping do that today. You know, there are very dedicated people out there, about 10,000 of them, that get up every day and go to IamTheWitness.com, and they get their dose of truth. And they're out there spreading this word, and we're fighting for the future of our planet, not just America.
And I know you're reaching a lot more people every day, because I had an event here. I had an event on Labor, on Veterans Day here about 9/11. And some of the people, some very well-heeled people came out from the city, and they said that they had heard me, and they had listened to you, and that you, you know, the you had opened their eyes. And I thought that was really nice to hear.
Well, it is good to hear, and I want to thank you again. You're welcome to come back on this broadcast, or if you've got a file you'd like to put up from an interview that you do, you're always welcome to post that here on our site, or in, you know, we'll do anything we're able to get this message out. But ladies and gentlemen, until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith saying thank you for listening. Bye-bye now. Be well.